are listening to Spoiler Alert Radio, all things film, locally and globally. Podcasting at spoileralertradio.com. I am your host, Tony Panacchia. On this episode of Spoiler Alert Radio, we speak with film editor Andrew Hafitz. Andrew has been editing films since 1995. Andrew's documentary credits include the street basketball movie Soul in the Hole, the documentary feature The Lifestyle Group Sex in the Suburbs, and the MTV show True Life, I'm in Iraq, which won the Edward R. Murrow Award for Best Network News Documentary. Along the way, Andrew has collaborated with some of the leading directors in the New York independent film scene, including Whit Stillman on Damsels in Distress and The Last Days of Disco, Lodge Kerrigan on Keen, and Larry Clark on Ken Park and Bully. Andrew's other narrative projects include two Sundance premiering films, Braden King's Here, a metaphysical road movie filmed on location in Armenia, and Don't Let Me Drown for Cruz Angeles, shot primarily in Brooklyn. Andrew is currently editing the film Very Good Girl, starring Dakota Fanning and Elizabeth Olsen. Welcome, Andrew Hafitz, to Spoiler Alert Radio.
Great to be here.
First of all, you know, tell us about your interest in editing film after, you know, having an initial background studying comparative literature at Yale.
When I went to college, and even after I graduated from college, I had no idea that I'd be working in film. I really didn't know what I was going to do. Looking back, I can see how I managed to get here. I was a big film fan. I took a couple of film appreciation courses in college, and one photography course, actually. I'd been writing a lot of papers and reading a lot of literature, but I hadn't really tapped into the visual that much until that photography course, and it kind of turned my head around. I also, through college and even in high school, did radio. So a lot of what you do in live radio is put different things next to each other. And that does relate to what I do in film, which is putting images and sounds next to each other in what I hope is an interesting way. So I didn't know that then, but I got out of college and I had a job in publishing, and I actually was a copy editor for a publishing house. After a couple of years of doing that, I found my way into the film business as a production assistant and kind of hated it, hated the hours, hated the sort of on-set vibe. I didn't really think I'd last in that part of film work. It occurred to me that I might try editing. I didn't really understand what editors did. One day, I went into an editing room and offered my services, eventually came on as an intern, and I felt at home immediately in a way that I wasn't on set. I was able to look at film, give my opinion on it in ways that were really not asked on set. The editor turned around and said, "What do you think of this cut?" My first day, and generally what I was getting on set was do this, do that, clean up, you know, that kind of thing. So it really turned me around. My first day in the editing room.
So one of your earlier works was the first of two projects with Whit Stillman, a film called The Last Days of Disco, set in the backdrop of the high-end nightclub scene in the very early 80s. How did you approach this project and working with Whit Stillman as a director to collaborate on a film like this?
I had worked with Whit as an assistant editor. Going back to that first day in the editing room, it was a documentary. It was called Funny. And the assistant editor on that project was a guy named Chris Tellefson. And Chris went on to edit Metropolitan, Whit Stillman's first film. I didn't work with Chris and Whit on that film, although I was certainly in touch. It was too low budget even to work on as an assistant. So I passed up that opportunity. But I did work on Barcelona as an assistant. So I knew Whit very, very well. And I was an enormous fan of Metropolitan as that film was made. And Chris actually, you know, has had a great career. Most recently, he's best known for editing Moneyball, for which he was nominated for an Oscar. So I learned quite a bit from Chris and Whit, and in watching them work, that was really my kind of primary education in the way editors and directors can work together and what you can do with, you know, an assembly and turning it into a movie. So in preparing for Last Days of Disco, I had already edited a feature at that point, but I was hired as an associate editor on The Last Days of Disco. But the man who was hired as editor about 2 or 3 weeks into production became ill, and I kind of took over. And he came back, and we ended up co-editing the film. So it was a great chance for me. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time.
The Last Days of Disco, it's a very vignette-styled film, something that Whit Stillman tends to do in his movies, as opposed to, you know, yes, there is a story that's happening, but it's more about the locations than it is the story. So how do you work this out as an editor?
Well, I think what the approach is, it's like any film, you know, footage is shot and you try to make the scenes work as best you can. And then how it all fits together is something you figure out in the weeks and months that follow production. So really, it's a matter of getting it down, you know, to script, and then from there, figuring out the style and the pacing and so on. Whit Stillman is very distinct in his voice, and plot is, you know, there is always plot with him, but it's really the turn of a phrase and the situations the characters find themselves in that is primary. Plot does become secondary. Nevertheless, you need to keep the film moving and the story moving, and you find a way to do it. And that is just a lot of trial and error. I think every editor's job is to give birth to the film that each director has, you know, dreamed up and usually written. It never will be exactly that, but Larry Clark and Whit Stillman are in different universes. So what I contribute to each of them is, you know, there is a bit of me in all of that for both, but, you know, it'd probably be difficult to recognize, actually, because the worlds are so completely different. I happen to like both directors as filmmakers, you know, just as a fan of film. And I see my role as helping them along to achieve their vision.
You know, you've also worked on documentaries over the years. You know, so tell us about the editing process for you on, say, a documentary like one of your earlier ones, Soul in the Hole, about street basketball.
Soul in the Hole specifically for me was the first real cutting I did. So it was really an education, and I learned a tremendous amount about how to use footage and how to make footage work. With documentary, you never, or only rarely, do you get the shot that you might have dreamed in order to make a scene work. So it was a great education for me in using the footage that's available and figuring out how. It's a lot harder, in my opinion, than cutting a feature because you don't know the story, you don't have a script, and you never have the right shot. So I find that documentary editing has really informed the way I approach feature editing in that it allows me to be more creative, or that mindset forces you to be more creative in your use of footage. You know, it's possible to never have worked in documentary and to be a great editor, of course, but it just informs everything I do, basically, is how to use footage in a new creative way. You know, in features, every shot is theoretically intentional, but, you know, there's always at the beginnings and ends of takes, accidents that happen. Using that kind of material, it happens in most features as well, and it always, always, always happens in documentary. So for me, it was a great education. I learned a lot on that film. I was really just an additional editor on that film, so I learned quite a bit from the director, Danielle Gardner, and the editor, Melissa Nydick.
You are listening to Spoiler Alert Radio, all things film, locally and globally. On this episode of Spoiler Alert Radio, we are talking with film editor Andrew Hayfetz, whose work includes The Last Days of Disco, Bully, Keen, Don't Let Me Drown, Here, and Damsels in Distress. You know, you've also worked on some other documentaries, including The Lifestyle, Group Sex in the Suburbs, and some TV documentary work like True Life, I'm Living in Iraq. You know, how do you change gears on these various subjects and styles and formats, you know, TV versus, you know, theatrical as an editor?
Well, I watch TV and I go to the movies. So I change styles just the way I would, you know, when I sit down and watch something, I have some idea of what to expect on television and some idea what to expect, you know, when I sit down and go to the movies. You know, you have to do a lot of different things when you work in the field. You know, I'm a craftsperson, and my ability to have range is largely how, you know, I can't just be doing one thing. I wouldn't work enough to earn a living. So you've got to be able to do different things, and it's part of my job. And I mean, just in the same way, a lot of what I do is recut scenes in a different way. given, you know, a piece of direction that a director will give me. My job is always to be reinventing the scene in a new way, giving it a different color, a different emphasis, a different meaning. You know, it's changing meaning. It's manipulating images and sounds to change meaning. So I think that applies to, you know, documentary versus feature, television versus features also. Specifically with True Life, there's a very, very strict format there. You know, you have to follow that format, but then you add your own distinct voice to it. Or you know, in this case, the director and producer, David Siskal, had worked in television prior to making The Lifestyle, and I worked with him on those True Life episodes that we did. I did a couple of them with him, and, you know, he's one of my favorite people to work with, and his approach determined my approach in a lot of ways.
Moving back to narrative, with Larry Clark on Bully and also on Ken Park, these films and subjects are shot in a more raw fashion and, you know, we'd think would be edited to match that. So can you elaborate on that process of working with someone like Larry Clark on these types of films?
With Larry and with every director and actually every cinematographer, everybody's a little different. And I think the footage calls out to be edited in a certain way, to some degree at least, that these raw images, you know, demand, at least in my mind, a different aesthetic kind of cut. So there's a bit of a brutality to the images, and there's a bit of a brutality maybe to the cutting in Bully and in Ken Park. Ken Park is much more lyrical than Bully, I think, because it was shot by somebody who's also a great DP, Ed Lachman, and there's a lyrical quality to the way he takes pictures. So, as I said before, different films want different kinds of editing. Another example of that in my work, I think, is Lodge Kerrigan's Keen, which is about a paranoid schizophrenic. And the way it's shot, it's all handheld, mainly very tight, and actually every cut in the film is a jump cut, a time cut. There actually are very few edits, the fewest in any feature I've cut, hands down. Nevertheless, there's a lot of editing going on. The first cut of that film was close to 3 hours, and it ended up being a 93-minute film with scenes definitely in a different order from the way they were scripted. So every project's a little different, and I come at it as an audience member of what would feel right. That doesn't always jive with what the director is thinking, but that's where you get into the collaborative part of what the director feels comfortable with. That kind of style is what works for the film you're making.
On a film like Bully for Larry Clark, you know, how do you develop engaging yet disturbing characters, you know, based on reality, like the character of Donnie? And also, how do you work with him as far as selecting how much is too much to show as far as these sort of graphic sex and violence scenes?
Well, with Bully, I mean, just specifically that character that you're talking about, Donnie, played by Michael Pitt. I've never met Donnie, and I don't really know what he's like. I did read the book, which the movie is based on, called Bully. And the author clearly hated this kid and his portrayal of the kid. You know, it was a true crime. But the author really had a lot of vitriol in particular for that kid, Donnie. And a lot of what these kids say in the movie, their dialogue, is lifted from the book quite a bit. I couldn't give you a percentage. But Michael Pitt, and how much Larry Clark directed this and how much was Michael Pitt's own, what he brought to the character, I can't tell you, but Michael Pitt played him as kind of a lovable stoner who did, you know, it's up to your own interpretation. That was his interpretation, is that he made him funny and he made him kind of lovable, whereas there was no love in the author's depiction of him. Now, in reality, is the kid lovable? I really don't know. But this is, in Bully, was the way it was played, and I thought Michael Pitt gave a performance so that I could understand, that we, as the audience, could understand, perhaps, some of this motivation and how something like this could have happened. You know, murderers are real people, and I think Larry's interested in showing that, you know, they have three dimensions. You know, they're not as simple as you might think. And, you know, Michael Pitt was so strong in that film that, you know, it was when in doubt, cut to him, because he was always doing something interesting. And he was like a lot of kids I knew when I grew up in suburbia, to some degree. You know, I recognized that as a real person and really loved doing the work on it. You know, in terms of how far you go, how explicit, You know, Larry is an artist. He's one of the great photographers of the last, I don't know, from the early 70s forward. I knew him as a photographer long before, you know, I was a fan of his photography. And he really crossed so many boundaries in his photography that, you know, for him, film is just another step. The difference is that this is a business and people invest, you know, millions of dollars into these films. And I think contractually he was required to deliver an R. A lot of stuff he shot went over that line, and the movie came out actually as unrated or NC-17, I don't remember which. You know, why he wants to cross those boundaries is he wants to show that teenagers have sex lives, and essentially our society doesn't really sanction that. So, you know, I don't really know how to say much more than that, is that teenagers do in fact have sex lives, and this is what he wants to show. And he wants it to be as real as it can be and get away with as much as he can while making these films. If he can cross that boundary and he's allowed to, he'll do it.
All right. Well, you mentioned Keen earlier. Let's come back to that. It deals with the mental instability of a man who has a lost daughter to kidnappers. So how did you work from an editing perspective to showing his state of bewilderment?
Well, I think the actor, again, really brought a lot to it. You know, a lot of editing is working with performance, and in this case it was Damian Lewis who just won the Emmy for Homeland for Best Actor. He's a great actor. He brought so much to that. I just watched Keen the other night for the first time in a few years. And from an editorial perspective, you're trying to capture that state of mind and make the cuts, accentuate it and underline it and not get in the way of a great performance. That film was designed to be shot in single takes, so there is no coverage. Maybe I should explain what coverage is. Generally speaking, you shoot a scene from different angles so that if a conversation is occurring between two people, you'll have the option of being on either one actor or the other. In this case, all of those choices were made in camera, and each shot was designed that way. So the editing was less about which character should I be on. Instead, it was how do I get from one thing to the next and accentuate what the actor is doing and tell the story in the most powerful way.
How did you tackle the romantic struggle of the young adults featured in Don't Let Me Drown and sort of build this story and build the closure of these characters? You know, one other thing to bear in mind is their world versus the adults featured in the film seem to be approached differently.
Yeah, definitely. In that film, the arc of the kid's story was much easier to work with than the arc of the parent's story, just because the parents, specifically the girl's parents, there wasn't a lot of arc there. There's a lot of anger, you know, understandable. The older sister of the character, Steph's sister, has died in the World Trade Center at 9/11. So there's a lot of rage that her parents have, specifically her father. So really the hardest part was making his character work, you know, as a background to the, you know, sort of Romeo and Juliet story of the boy and the girl, of Lalo and Steph. And I think we had really nice performances from the two kids. So it was a lot of fun, and the director, Cruz Angeles, is great to work with. He's an editor himself, so he was a lot of fun to work with for me. And, you know, had a lot of ideas about how to do that. I think the main thing we did was to help Steph's father's character was, you know, he's got this boiling rage, and he hits his wife, and so on and so forth. There's a scene where he checks the phone message, his last phone message from his dead daughter, and it had come really early in the film, and we put it at the end of the film, and it kind of made his character sit better. You know, it extended his arc as this is why he has so much rage. It's because at the end, all he can do is listen to his daughter's phone messages. And it just kind of completed his character a little bit better than having that scene early.
You are listening to Spoiler Alert Radio, all things film, locally and globally. On this episode of Spoiler Alert Radio, we are talking with film editor Andrew Hayfetz, whose work includes The Last Days of Disco, Bully, Keen, Don't Let Me Drown, Here, and Damsels in Distress. How how did you interweave the more sort of poetic segments to the dramatic segments of the film here, and also work with kind of weaving in the locations of this sort of road trip aspect to the film here?
It was really scripted to be that and to work with experimental film. So it was kind of in the script, and then it was a matter of just executing, making it fit into the broader story, which, you know, essentially it's a road movie romance with sort of metaphysical, I'm not sure metaphysical is the right word, but it's about a map maker and a photographer, and they're both different kinds of ways of finding truth in the world, if you will, capturing moments and images to explain how the world works. And I think that's what Here is getting at, is those relationships and exploring those relationships, and even within, like, making a movie, you know, the hard work of making a movie, and also just film stock and flash frames and that kind of thing of, you know, you're mapping a story. When you shoot a film, you're mapping a story, as well as this is about a character who's trying to map Armenia.
Well, let's now talk about Damsels in Distress. You know, tell us about your involvement initially as an editor on Damsels in Distress. And is there any comparison to that versus working on Last Days of Disco?
Well, Damsels in Distress was done really low budget. That's one major difference. You know, it was around $1 million, and Damsels in Distress is around $10 million. There's a lot of similarity. Certainly, you recognize Whit Stillman's voice. But the humor is a lot broader in Damsels in Distress, I would say. There's a lot more physical comedy. Yet, at the same time, it shares so many aspects of Whit's earlier three films. There's always music and dancing in his films, at least so far. So it was a combination that I think Whit wanted to get back to the metropolitan style of working really low budget and really quickly. And also, you know, for practical reasons, you know, raising money to make a film is not the easiest thing, and it took him many, many years to be able to do it. So in this case, it was Greta Gerwig, who I think gave a great performance, and Chris Eigenman is not in the film, and he kind of, in more or less, if not carries, he's a really important feature to the other three Whit Stillman films. So it was more up to Greta Gerwig playing Violet to carry this movie.
Great. So you mentioned about dancing. Damsel in Distress does feature, you know, a fair amount of dance scenes, including, you know, and it's an extended dance scene towards the end of the film. So how do you work with editing dance?
It's pretty much the same way you edit anything else, except there's music, you know, music that's attached, or, you know, that changes also. You find the best moments, put them together, and hope it is smooth and musical and tells a story other than just these people are dancing. You know, you try to make it more interesting than that. Editing is, you know, at the most simple part is getting rid of all the bad stuff. In a more complicated way, you are trying to tell a story as you do it. So it's just really keeping that going. I mean, the big long dance sequence, the story is pretty much told by that time. So it's really, you know, a matter of choosing the best shots and making them work with music and featuring the best moments. It's, of course, much harder than that, but that's the approach. You know, there are always issues and problems, and my job is to solve them and make it seem like this was the idea all along, you know, as if there was one focused idea. And usually there isn't one focused idea. It's usually a lot of ideas, and you pick the best one or you create one in the editing room.
So as far as the tone in Damsels in Distress, you know, Damsels in Distress starts out more as a satirical comedy, but then, you know, gets a bit more, you know, sentimental and heartfelt as the film progresses. From an editing perspective, you know, how do you achieve subtle changes in tone?
Well, I think that's the progression of the story. You know, a lot of what editors do is work with performance and script. And once in a while, you have a problem where you don't have enough. But it's a matter of bringing out the core of the story and figuring out what works and keeping the audience involved, or trying to, at least. You know, it's always an effort against, you know, boring an audience or keeping as many people in it as you can. So, you know, we have in that situation, when you say there's a subtle change in tone, it often just happens. And if it feels right, it's great. But do I say, okay, here's where the tone should shift? Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. In that case, it probably was just a function of, you know, what we had and where the script went and where the actors took us.
Well, tell us about your upcoming and future work, including the film Very Good Girls.
Well, we're in the middle of post-production. on Very Good Girls. The lead is Dakota Fanning, and Elizabeth Olsen's in it, and Ellen Barkin, Richard Dreyfuss, Demi Moore. So it has a lot of stars in it. It's very well played. The director is Naomi Foner. It's the first time she's directed. In 1988, I think, she was nominated for an Oscar for Best Screenplay for Running on Empty, directed by Sidney Lumet, and River Phoenix was in that. And she's probably never, even though she's been an Oscar-nominated screenwriter, she's probably best known as the mother of Maggie and Jake Gyllenhaal. And actually, Maggie Gyllenhaal's husband, Peter Sarsgaard, is in this film, and he's a terrific actor. So it's the story of two young girls just graduated from high school who set out to lose their virginity over the summer after high school because everyone they know already has, and they both fall for the same guy. So it's a real test of their friendship.
In any other projects of note upcoming?
You know, I'm not really sure what's going to happen to it. I'm really proud of a short I edited right before Very Young Girls called American Autumn. I noticed that there's a documentary called American Autumn that just came out. I hope we can keep the name for the short. But it's directed by a young Spaniard named Albert Moya. It's in English, and it's about a group of friends who have a dinner party, and there's a lot of back and forth about who's been sleeping with whom and that kind of thing. One of them is pregnant, et cetera, et cetera. The catch is that all the actors are played by children between the ages of 6 and 12. So it's kind of this drawing room comedy. It's not quite a comedy. It's actually very sad, but kids play adult roles, and I'm really into it. It's kind of great. I'm really excited for it, and I hope people see it in festivals shortly.
All right, well, thanks so much, Andrew Hafitz, for taking the time to talk with us today on Spoiler Alert Radio.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Spoiler Alert Radio, all things film, locally and globally, podcasting at spoileralertradio.com. I've been your host, Tony Pinacchia. On this episode of Spoiler Alert Radio, we spoke with film editor Andrew Hafitz. Andrew's documentary credits include the films Soul in the Hole, the lifestyle group Sex in the Suburbs, and the MTV show True Life, I'm in Iraq. Andrew's narrative projects include Braden King's Here, a metaphysical road movie filmed on location in Armenia, and Cruz Angeles, Don't Let Me Drown, shot primarily in Brooklyn. Andrew has also collaborated with some of the leading directors in the New York independent film scene, including Whit Stillman on Damsels in Distress and The Last Days of Disco, Lodge Kerrigan on Keen, and Larry Clark on Ken Park and Bully. For more information on Andrew Hafitz and his work, go to andrewhafitz.com or click the links under the show information for this episode at spoileralertradio.com. Spoiler Alert Radio is a Merging Arts production produced by Tony Pinacchia and Paul Elsner. Thanks for listening.